All right, I'm sorry for our late start. We are going to be studying about the facts of the matter, the holy matter. What page? So we're on Daf Chaf Hei, which is page 25 of the big folio pages of the Talmud. Because those pages are crammed full of information, in the English translation they usually find themselves over a couple of pages. So it's 25A, and maybe it's 3 or 4, right toward the end of the page. So let me give you a couple of brief prefaces before we begin to engage in the mental gymnastics of trying to properly understand what the Gemara tells us. Premise number one. Our world, Zugesund, is comprised of essentially three elements from a spiritual perspective. That which is sacred or holy, and therefore has to be used for holy purposes. That which is mundane, but not prohibited. So when we use it purposefully, it too can be elevated, but it doesn't have specific parameters, and it's not governed by a series of exact laws of how it should be utilized. So as long as you utilize it meaningfully in some way, then that becomes a meaningful way to live life. And then there are things which are prohibited entirely. So let's talk about something like a Sefer Torah. Sefer Torah would be called holy. Everybody would agree? What happens if I use the Sefer Torah for something that's meaningful? It's meaningful for me, but it violates the sacred nature of the Sefer Torah. For example, I really am experiencing discomfort because it's hot in this room and the window won't stay open. But if I could just prop the window open and get a little fresh air, I would probably be able to do a lot of good things. So I just take the Sefer Torah and I kind of jam it under the window to keep the window open. How does that sound? That's not good, right? But I'm doing something meaningful. I'm going to study Torah. No good, right? I'm going to have to agree with you. That's no good. We would call that in English sacrilege. Because something which has been designated for a holy purpose can only be used for a sacred purpose. Now, incidentally, the word holiness in Hebrew, which is kadosh or kedusha, comes from the terminology designated. Kadosh u'muvdol. Something which is set aside. So, for example, marriage is also known as holiness. Marriage is called kiddushin. And that's because there's a certain part of the human condition which is supposed to be graced by the holiness of marriage. And it's a little counterintuitive, because most people would tend to think that that part of the human condition is very base, it's very ordinary, it's very mundane or pedestrian. I refer here to human sexuality or intimacy. In most faith systems, it's frowned upon. And the majority of spiritual seekers would think that a true spiritual seeker is one who would forswear this kind of behavior, stay away from it, because it can only bring you down. But that, in fact, in Judaism, is totally untrue, totally, to the point that our homes are said to be a replication, a reflection of the Holy Temple. The holiest place in the Holy Temple was the inner sanctum, or the Holy of Holies, Kodesh HaKadoshim, which is where the Ark and the Luchot resided. And in the schematic of a Jewish home, the bedroom is the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the Holy of Holies. And that's a private place. That's a place for the unique relationship between a husband and wife. And the Torah says that that's specific. And because it's specific, it's not okay if we do things like this just like that. Things like this have to be done in a very precise and unique and special way, not just like that. To us, the sexual revolution represents the climax of unholiness, taking something which has been understood and appreciated by most people as being special and sacred, making it mundane, which is actually the meaning of the word sliz. Sliz means to cheapen. So that's supposed to be something so sacred, so special, and now it's available for free. Anybody can get it. Whatever you want. As long as two adults are consenting, society sees absolutely no reason to have any holiness invested in it. Nothing, no special attention has to be given towards it. So if a man stops in the store to pick something up and the person behind the counter is a married woman, it's not a sin if he got change from her, right? Because that's not the part of the behavior which is changed by marriage. Marriage doesn't say, oh, don't get change from a married woman. A single woman you get change from, or you must get change from your wife only, or vice versa. Because that's not what we call special or sacred. That's not hallowed. But intimate behavior is something else. So that would be kind of another example of the Sefer Torah. That's another example of it. And our society, which fights holiness, which even abhors holiness, tragically and sadly, doesn't even understand this anymore. What's the issue? What does it need to have holy matrimony? Ha! Holy matrimony. It's a bunch of mumbo jumbo. It's baloney. So that's the story of holiness. Then we have the vast majority of things in life which are neither holy nor unholy. For example, let's talk about food. Is food holy? Sacred? I mean, it could be used for holy purpose. It depends why we eat. If we eat like animals, for the purposes of indulgence, to satisfy our libido, to be sated and entertained and feel good, and what we do with that food is irrelevant, then we made food a mundane activity. However, if we eat with the purpose of doing something good, which means we will use this energy to serve God, so then we took something which could be mundane and we made it holy. Anybody tired now? It's late at night. You a little tired? Hashem made this wonderful thing called coffee. Now, if you're drinking coffee now, and the purpose of drinking the coffee is so that you should remain awake and alert to study Talmud, what happens to the coffee? It becomes holy. So now do you have to bow to it and treat it specially? Should it be reverential coffee? No. It doesn't become a Sefer Torah. But still, it can be used for a holy purpose. Of course, it can be used for an unholy purpose. Many years ago, when I was living in Eretz Yisrael, there was a terrible terrorist attack in the streets of Jerusalem on a Thursday night. It was two of the students from the yeshiva called Ateret Kohanim, and they were walking home from yeshiva, and a terrorist attacked them and shot them, and one was murdered. And I was living there, and actually one of the boys who was murdered, a close friend of his, used to come and study with me. So I felt very close to it, and I knew all the details. Till today, I can tell you exactly where it happened and all the details, it's like burned into my memory. So one of the things I remember that they found a cup of coffee that the murderer had planned everything, this terrorist. He was sipping coffee just before he committed his dastardly act of murder. Incidentally, he was never caught. So he was drinking coffee to stay alert. Alert so he could murder a 16-year-old boy. How holy do you think that coffee is? Not holy, right? That coffee has been denigrated to the lowest levels of reality. It was used for the most horrific thing. A tale of two coffees. The coffee that's used so somebody could be alert and study Torah or pray or do somebody a favor. Coffee that could be used to keep somebody alert so you can commit an act of murder. There are a lot of things in the world like that. There depends what you do with it. And then there are things which are unholy, like not kosher food, for example. So not kosher food, most not kosher food, what's not kosher about it is its designation as food is not kosher. So for example, the pig is not kosher food. But the pig is kosher for football. There's nothing wrong with playing football, even if they use pigskin to make the football. Because you're using it for non-food, a non-edible purpose. It's only unkosher insofar as food is concerned. The moment it's not food, or the moment it's not being used for food, is not an issue. If somebody has a weak heart, Rahman al-Litzan, and his valves have to be replaced because he has a heart disease, the most effective heart replacement today is a pig valve. And there's nothing unkosher about that. To have a dinner of roasted pig valves is a problem. To have a pig valve inserted and keep your heart going, great, that's a mitzvah, saving a life. And then there are other things which are not kosher altogether. It means we can't benefit from them. That means any kind of benefit is a problem. Most famously, chametz. Chametz is not kosher. But it's not just not kosher. Not only does the Torah tell us you can't eat it, the Torah tells us that chametz, which is leaven during the 7 or 8 days of Pesach, is so prohibited that if you were to benefit from it in any way, shape, or form, that too would be a violation. In other words, the evil nature or the ungodly nature of this reality is such that not only can you not benefit through its form as an edible, but any form, even just using its matter, would be a problem. So for example, if you took chametz, bread, and you heated an oven, burn the bread, a lot of bread. Eventually, burn enough bread, you're going to generate the heat. And you bake matzah in the oven on Pesach that was heated with chametz. But by the time the matzah gets in there, there's no chametz whatsoever. It's ashes. What would the halacha be? Can't do it. Why not? Now, the matzah would not be unkosher, by the way. The matzah would still be kosher matzah. But you'd be benefiting. Because by incinerating the chametz, you benefited because you're able to bake matzah. Or roast peppers, whatever it might be. You understand what I'm saying? So we're dealing with now with holy matter. And the interesting thing about holy matter is that it can't just be used just like that. Holy matter has to be used in a specific way. The thing with holy matter is that just as it has specific laws that govern it, you must use it in this fashion, and if you use it in an ordinary fashion, you would be, in a sense, violating its holiness. But along with that comes the idea that it could be spoiled, and it could be disqualified. And if it's disqualified, it can no longer be used for a holy purpose. Do you understand what I'm saying? Let me give you an example. Grain that grows in the holy land of Eretz Yisrael is holy. I didn't start yet inside, Mark. Don't worry, I'm going to start soon. I promise you. I'm just trying to give you the preface because tonight's Gemara could be boring and it could be taxing. So I'm trying to make it a little more interesting so when we actually get to the give and take of the Gemara, you'll say, oh, well, that kind of fits in with the whole schematic that we talked about. I'm giving you a little bit of a spiritual schematic because all of Torah ultimately is connected to a spiritual schematic. Eretz Yisrael is a holy land. What does it mean Eretz Yisrael is a holy land? What is the definition of holiness? How about if I tell you it can be used for a holy purpose? Or it has a predisposition for a godly or holy purpose. What might that mean? It means that God says to us, if you will behave in a certain way in this land, your mitzvahs will be more meaningful. And even the things that are produced in the soil of this land, because this is sacred soil, what we call Admat Kodesh, Eretz HaKodesh, even the Artziut, even the material matter is infused with a sense of godly mission and purpose. And because it's infused with that added measure of godly mission and purpose, that which grows from it is not ordinary. It has holy potential. Now, I have to warn you that just as a mitzvah performed in Eretz Yisrael is more meaningful, in Aveda, a sin which is done in Eretz Yisrael is more egregious. You know, it goes two ways. So if somebody's going to do a mitzvah, where's the best place in the world to do the mitzvah? Israel. If somebody's going to do a sin, where's the worst place in the world to do the sin? In Israel. It's not so simple. There are even those great leaders of the medieval times, the Rishonim, who believed that it wouldn't be a good idea to live in Israel unless you're up to it. It's not a simple thing. I'm not. I know this is a fraught topic, and I'm not even going into this. So I want to open the can of worms. But it's not a simple thing. In general, there's something very important in life, and especially in Yiddishkeit, it's called nuance. Nuance is an important thing. There's this assumption, for example, that the best place to get buried is in the land of Israel. It's not so simple. In fact, the Zohar says that bringing bodies to Israel is not appropriate. Yeah. They said, you want to live in Israel, come live in Israel in your life. Say, no, live? Who could live in Israel? It's too much. I'll bring my body to Israel. Israel is a place to send bodies to. It's a place to bury corpses. How does that sound? And there's a dispute amongst the Rishonim. And the consensus is that a person who lived a holy life, it makes sense to bury them in Israel. Because they lived a holy life. But a person who lived a profane life, not a good idea to bring their body to Israel. All I'm saying is, it's not black and white. Yiddishkeit, Torah, is filled with nuance. Not the nuance of our own imagination, but the nuance of our tradition. Not simple. Okay. Now, this holy land of Israel that produces holy produce, what should we do with it? What do you do with this holy produce? You eat it, but it's holy. There's a story told that in the early 50s, the Rebbetzin of Lubavitch had to leave. Rebbetzin, Rebbetzin Chaim Moshka. So the Rebbe was going to have dinner made by somebody, one of the local Hasidim's wives was going to come over and prepare dinner and leave dinner on the table, and the Rebbe come home to be dinner. Her name was Mrs. Dubinsky. And she called the Rebbetzin in a panic, like a day before, questioning the Rebbetzin again and then again. She said, but where will I make the food? So the Rebbetzin said, make it at home and you'll bring it over to the house. You'll leave the food in the house. So she said, on my stove? So the Rebbetzin said, Ihr meint as bei mir in Even tanzen malochim? You think in my oven there's angels dancing? That's what she said. Like, the name Dubinsky was the name of this Hasidic woman who was going to...
Wow. That's
your name?
My mom's.
Oh, wow. Ashkacha Pratis, I told the story then. So that was the story. That was the story that she said, make the food and bring it over. She said, but what? Kosher food you killed? Okay, kosher food. Well, like, why do you, like, what is the issue? What do you mean food? Food in Israel is holy. What should we do with it? Should we sing and dance before we eat? Well, what should we do? There is halachas. Torah says, so the food in Israel, because it's so holy, you can't just eat it. First, you have to separate a small portion of the food, and the holiness that's on the entire crop kind of gets concentrated onto one small part of it. And when it gets concentrated onto one small part of it, that part becomes holy and sacred, and then the rest of the food is permissible. Do you know what that small portion, that concentrated, packed-up holiness is called? Truma. What does the Hebrew word truma mean? It literally, in Hebrew, means to lift. Laharim means to lift up. So this is a little bit of food that's lifted up from the rest. Try to think in your mind's eye. You see like a whole spread of produce, and all of a sudden, a few stalks kind of grow taller. They're like lifted up. Now, what do we do with this holy stuff? Have no fear. So the Torah says there are some people who are given an added measure of holiness. They have a different kind of neshama. How do you get this neshama? Do you have to pay for it? Do you earn it? No. It's by virtue of your birth. It's not different than any other neshama. How do you how do you get a neshama? If your mother was Jewish, you get a neshama. What if your mother wasn't Jewish? Well, if you were inspired to join the Jewish people, there must be a neshama waiting for you. You must convert according to the halacha, and then you will lay claim to this neshama, and you will download that neshama. Being Jewish is something you can become, even if you weren't born. However, being a Kohen is something you have to be born with. You cannot say, I think I'd like to convert to be a Kohen. Rabbi, how do I bump up my neshama? How do I add on a few megs of RAM now? So, sorry, can't do that. You can become Jewish, but you cannot become a Kohen. And what makes you a Kohen? Well, the specific sets of halacha. The simple thing is your father has to be a Kohen. Your father is a Kohen, and you can be a Kohen. And the Kohen has added responsibilities. because he has a bigger burden of holiness. The bigger burden of holiness makes the Kohen's life difficult. The Kohen can't go to a funeral. That's challenging. The Kohen can't marry any Jewish woman. Regular man can, not a Kohen. He has even more limitations. The Kohen has to try to keep himself in a state of constant ritual purity, which can be an extremely taxing activity. Why? Because in order for the Kohen to do his special thing, he has to be in a state of ritual purity. Now, the Kohen who does all those special things now has the burden and the privilege of a unique measure of spirituality.
The Kohen is a rabbi. Can the Kohen officiate at a funeral or not?
That's a really good question. If a Kohen is a rabbi, can he officiate at a funeral? So let me say this. Becoming a rabbi does not in any way, shape, or form change you as a person. It's not like marriage, which actually changes a woman who's married. So a woman who is a non-Kohen, who marries a Kohen, she becomes a Kohen by the ages of marriage. But getting smicha, getting ordained as a rabbi, is not a sacred event. Nothing changes. What's the difference between a rabbi and a Jew who's not a rabbi? What's the difference?
Education.
Absolutely nothing. There is no intrinsic difference. They are both equally responsible for keeping the Shabbat. They are both equally responsible following the laws of Kashrut. They are both equally responsible for doing their best in inspiring others. Only, the rabbi, by dint of the fact that he has much more knowledge and has dedicated his life, so he freed up his involvement with other things, he would be more responsible. But then again, it could be a person who's extremely knowledgeable and extremely charismatic and extremely capable, and he didn't get smicha. So, being a rabbi doesn't change you. So if you're a Kohen, you were a Kohen when you were born, and you'll be a Kohen forever. And nothing you do can ruin, you can't take away your kahuna. You can violate your kahuna, at which time you can't enjoy the privileges, but being a rabbi can't change it. So what happens to a rabbi who's a Kohen? He can't really officiate at a funeral. It's rather odd. You know, the rabbi's like speaking from another room. Or he can't go to the feld. It doesn't change anything.
But Rabbi, being a Kohen doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to live your life as a good person.
Ah, very good question. Being a Kohen doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to live your life as a good person, is what you said. That is absolutely correct. Who said that the definition of being a Kohen is a good person?
But what if you violate being a Kohen? Does that get taken away?
Oh, same kind of question. So let me answer your question first, and I'll answer your question, which is, if you violate kahuna, do you lose it? Being a good person is the potential that every one of us was given. Just because we were given that potential doesn't mean we're going to be a good person. We have to make that choice. But I can't choose to be a good Kohen because I'm not a Kohen. I could just choose to be a good Jew or not, chas v'shalom. Now, my brother-in-law is a Kohen. He has an added choice to make. Should he be not only a good Jew, but a good Kohen too? So I become a good Jew in part by going to funerals. And he can be a good Kohen by avoiding funerals. We have different paths sometimes. Nancy, you asked a really good question. So what happens to a Kohen who marries somebody a Kohen is not supposed to marry, right? So the urban legend is, oh, you just like you hang your kahuna up in a closet, and then you become a non-Kohen, and then whenever you want, you can just...
Huh?
Well, you certainly don't pass down the children through that union. In order to be able to pass down the privilege of kahuna, the union has to be an appropriate union. But here is the thing. If a person is to live an inappropriate life from a Kohanic perspective, they still are a Kohen. And they're living in sin. It doesn't mean the sin is absolved because they chose not to be a Kohen. However, inasmuch as they're violating their kahuna flagrantly and publicly, we cannot honor them with the privileges. So the Kohen is married in an inappropriate way. We can't give him the first aliyah. We can't say, oh, please bless us now. No, that's a privilege that a Kohen gets. Am I making sense? Is it reasonable to say that a Kohen is holier than a regular Jew? I don't know. Yes or no? What does holiness mean? The Kohen has an added possibility of holiness. Kohen has an added possibility. That means the Kohen, people say, huh, this Kohen is going to bless me? who the heck is he to bless me? He should beg me to bless him. Well, the Torah is who to say he should bless you. What's so good about him? Well, nothing. He has a neshama that's kind of built to serve as a conduit for blessing. That's just the way it is. So maybe the Kohen is a little holier or has holier potential. So this very sacred, special food called Terumah now is set aside. The rest of the food, the holiness is lifted because it goes into concentrate. And that concentrated small amount of food gets given to the Kohen. Now when I, as a good Jew, designate this set it aside for the Kohen, I'm being a good Jew. I'm giving what I harvested as an effective and good farmer. Now I'm being a good Jew by giving it to the Kohen. The Kohen has to remain in a state of ritual purity. And when the Kohen eats dinner, he makes not one bracha, I'm just going to make hamotzi lechem min ha'aretz. Enjoy your dinner. No, the Kohen says, not only hamotzi lechem min ha'aretz, the Kohen makes a second blessing on the food. Asher kedishanu b'kedushato shel Aharon v'tzivanu lechol truma. How cool is that? It's very cool. Very cool. So what happens if this Kohanic food, this Terumah, becomes defiled, becomes ritually impure? Maybe it was in a room and somebody died in that room. So anything under the same enclosure with the corpse has now become ritually impure. What do you do with this food? Can't eat it. It's not pure. It's not holy, it's not tahor. What should I do with it? So we learned you have to burn it. Just like you have to burn chametz, you have to burn the food.
Why is a corpse impure?
This is an excellent question for a different night, why a corpse is impure. In one sentence, a corpse or a body is something that contained the holiest thing in the world, which is a soul. When the soul vacates the body, it leaves an enormous vacuum. Vacuums are not healthy places. When a building empties out, it doesn't remain empty. What does it get filled with? Prostitution and drugs and wild animals. Because that's the nature.
Doesn't it take a while for the soul to leave a corpse?
Well, death is a moment. There's a moment of death in Judaism.
I see.
And you're either alive or not. So when you're not, now the neshama is gone. When the neshama is not living in the body, it leaves an enormous void. And that void is then open for all kinds of negative spiritual forces.
It's like the highest form of tzedakah, right?
Highest form of tzedakah, and we have to treat the body reverentially and give it tremendous dignity, but at the same time, it's also emptied of its meaning. So, this food that has to be burnt, we now have a question. Can I eat it? No, can't eat it. It's not allowed to be eaten. Can I benefit from it when it's getting burnt? That was the question. That was the question. Can I benefit from it when it's getting burnt? In other words, I've got a box of bread that was Terumah, and now it's tummy. So what should I do with that box of bread? What's the answer? I got to burn it. Well, can I put it in my furnace and heat the house with it? In the old days when they used to put things that could get burned. Is that a very good use for bread? No, you're treating bread like firewood. Not a good use for bread. But under the circumstances, I don't have anything else to do with the bread. What if it's olive oil? Now, olive oil is very useful. Olive oil, once upon a time, and especially in Talmudic times, was used as an ingredient in virtually everything. From baking to frying, from keeping people's skin soft and supple. I mean, olive oil was a basic commodity, one of the most basic commodities in the land of Israel. But the olive oil, that it's not pure, cannot be used in a normative sense. And in the Beit HaMikdash, it cannot even be used to kindle the menorah, which is the story of Hanukkah. They couldn't find pure olive oil. So what did they do? Couldn't light the menorah. They said, "Vay is me, the menorah has been dark for so long, and we finally recaptured our beloved Beit HaMikdash. We want to kindle the menorah. We have no pure olive oil." And finally, they found one little cruise, and that's a whole story in and of itself. And what should we do now? Fire up the cylinders. Pour the menorah. Fill it up. And what happened? Miraculously, it burnt and burnt and burnt and burnt for 8 days. So in the Beit HaMikdash, the olive oil cannot be impure. How about in the menorahs that we were just lighting on Hanukkah? Is it okay to use olive oil if you're a Kohen, that is? That's ritually impure? What do you say? Why not? You're not eating it. In fact, we say about the menorah, Hanera talalu kodeshim, these lights are holy. What does it mean that it's holy? In Lanu Rishut, we have no permission to use it for our own personal needs. That's why we kindle the shamash. That's why we have an extra candle, an extra flame burning, so we shouldn't utilize for personal needs the light that the menorah generates. You following? So that would be the question. Can we use that oil of teruma to light a menorah? Or maybe even a better question. How about on Friday night? Some people have a custom of lighting their Friday night lamps, Nerot Shabbat, with olive oil. Can I use the olive oil? And that is supposed to be used. I'm supposed to see where I'm going. It's supposed to create an ambiance. That's the beauty of Shabbat candles. Can I use that if I'm a Kohen to light Shabbat candles? Or can I use it just to have a lamp? Once upon a time, that's how people got around. The flashlight wasn't as convenient as your iPhone today. Once upon a time, you need a flashlight. You take a little lamp and fill it with oil and have a wick inside and you walk around with your little lamp like Aladdin. The Gemara seemed to believe that you may benefit from truma that's ritually impure. So we're learning Gemara, not halacha now. The Gemara says, okay, prove it to me. How do you know that? So you know, imagine you're dating somebody. You want to get to know them, right? So there's a dating process. And in the dating process, that's when you get to know people. And the dating process could be a lot of fun. It could also be onerous. You get to know somebody. And you get to know them, the more you ask them, the more you learn about them, the more you, and then your relationship continues. And you can keep learning about people. Good friendships, you keep learning about. Some person can be a friend with somebody for decades and say, I never knew who my friend was. I never knew my friend had the capacity for this kind of kindness or compassion. I never knew my friend had the capacity of being so wise or having so much patience. Sometimes people don't even find out who their real friends are until they're really in trouble. And then that's when you find out who your real friends are and your fake friends are. People who really care about you, people who really don't. Right? And trying circumstances can be very revealing. They can tell you a lot about it. So this is all like a metaphor for our relationship with Hashem. How do we have a relationship with God? Generally speaking, we have three ways, the three-pronged relationship with God. We study Torah, and Torah is God's wisdom. So the more Torah we study, the more we know God. God says, come figure me out. Come learn about me. How will I learn about God? How do I date God? If I study Torah. The more Torah I study, the more I know how this is how God thinks. This is how God looks at things. This is what God wants. When you know about a friend, you know what they want. You know what they want. If you care and love them, care about them, you want to do things that they like. How would you know? Get to know them. Another way is to actually do those things. And that's the performance of mitzvot. So we nurture a relationship with God by dint of the mitzvot we perform. And what's the last thing? The last thing is having an emotional connection with God, which is the concept of prayer. Now we're studying Torah. We study Torah with our minds. We pray with our hearts. We do mitzvahs with our hands and feet. So when we're talking about the mitzvah of Torah study, we're using our minds. And in our minds, we're trying to figure out what God wants. We're trying to figure God out through His Torah. So we have learned that the truma that has to be burnt, that this truma can't be eaten, but can be enjoyed. Or at least the heat that it generates can be used for our own purposes. You follow? It sound intriguing? Okay, so this is where you pick us up in the Gemara now. On page 25, 8 at the bottom. In the last class, the Gemara taught a Medrash to Rabbi Avohu, from the teaching, the expounding of Rabbi Avohu. The Rabbi Avohu shared with us in the name of Rabbi Yochanan that it speaks about something called Maaser Sheni. Maaser Sheni is the second tithe, so after the Truma, there is a percentage, 10% to be exact, that's separated and given to the Levi. By the way, it is not sacred. Even non-Levites can eat that. And then there's another 10%. And sometimes it's given to the poor, depending on which year in the agricultural cycle. And sometimes the Maaser Sheni is given, well, given to nobody. You keep it. Then what do I do with it that's holy or special? The answer is I go to the capital city of the Jewish people. The UN has no idea what that is, but we know what that is. Where's the capital city of the Jewish people?
Yerushalayim.
Has it ever been anybody else's capital city? No. So why do we have to renegotiate that? Aha, because the United Nations against Israel has a very important purpose, and that is to blot out the truth and usher in the lies. Okay, that doesn't bind us. We're not bound by lies. We are bound by the truth. So we go to the holy city of Yerushalayim, and in this holy city of Yerushalayim, we consume the Maaser Sheni. How do you consume Maaser Sheni? Well, it depends. The things which are beverages, you should drink. The things which are foodstuff or edibles, you should eat. And then the things which can sometimes be absorbed by the body in other manners, you can absorb in another way. For example, olive oil can be absorbed into the skin. And then the skin can be soft and supple. And then you can absorb olive oil into your body in a healthy way, sometimes by rubbing it into your skin. That's okay. And then the question becomes, what if it's ritually impure? Can I still use the Maaser Sheni? So the pasuk, the verse in Deuteronomy 26, verse 14 says, "V'le biyarti mimenu betame." I did not use it or burn it when it was in a state of ritual impurity. Now what this tells me is, if I have Maaser Sheni, which is the special sacred food that has to be brought to the holy city of Yerushalayim, and what is the meaning of a holy city? A city where you do holy things. What's holy things?
Sacrifices.
Whatever the Torah says, that's what's holy things. What if it doesn't feel holy? Who asked you? If God says it's holy, it's holy. It's like a person will say, I want to do loving things for the person I love. So what's that? Well, the person I love likes cereal and milk. So that's a romantic thing? Cereal and milk? It's ridiculous. But if that's what she likes, then that's romantic. Romantic is to be tuned into the needs of your lover, not your needs. That's ridiculous. I was dating my wife. So the night before we got engaged, we go to this Italian restaurant. Okay. I think it was called the Fontabella or something. And it's like one of these fancy restaurants, but my wife's not into this fancy, you know, fancy cuisine. She likes. So she says to the waiter, "Do you have ketchup?" So the waiter has like a cow. He's like, "This guy is taking you to a fancy restaurant. You want ketchup?" I'm like, "Mister, your job is to serve your clients, not yourself. Just answer the question. The girl wants ketchup, yes or no? Like, we don't have ketchup in this establishment. We shouldn't have come here." But the truth is, I didn't know my wife that well. I didn't know she don't like fancy food. And I thought I was being a big hero. I don't know. My brother-in-law said, "Take it to a fancy place." Take it to a fancy place. I know what I was doing, right? So by our wedding, she got the kids' meal. That's what she liked. That works. What's romantic? Whatever your lover likes. What's holy? Well, let's tell God what's holy. Let's tell God what's holy. God, you know, your idea of sacrifice is awful. It's really stupid, okay, God? Let me tell you what's holy, God. How does that sound? It sounds like idolatry. Because we create God in our own image, and then we tell that God of our own image what he likes. What is worshiping Hashem comprised of? It's comprised of doing what God wants. First, you have a relationship with somebody. That person likes ketchup. You come and say, "But why do you like ketchup? I'm giving you this fine Italian white rosé cream, and you want ketchup." And the person you love says, "Well, like, really? I just like ketchup, so can you bring me ketchup?" So you tell me, what would be the right thing to do?
So no questions asked to Elohim?
Many questions asked to God when you study his Torah. So you want to get to know him better. You can ask as many questions as you want, as long as you don't draw your own conclusions. However, when it comes to mitzvah observance, no, it's not about questions. It's about, you know, in the words of Rashi, about offering specifically, Amarti, God says, I said, v'naseh ritzoni, you did what I asked. That's what I asked, that's all. How would that relationship go? If the husband and the wife ask for something and the spouse says, that makes no sense to me. I don't want to do that for you. That's what I asked you for. Forget what you asked me for. Let me tell you what you would like. That wouldn't work.
I didn't mean it that way.
Don't get offended. Don't get offended. We're having a very frank conversation about Judaism and faith and religion. This is good. The point is, when it comes to mitzvahs, yeah, we listen to what God says. Yeah, we don't argue with God and say, God, this can't be holy, this can't be nice or good. So is Yerushalayim a holy city? What does that mean? It means, first and foremost, in a very technical, legalistic sense, that's where certain mitzvahs can be done. And then, as we learned in our previous class, every few years we have a mitzvah to come to the Beis HaMikdash and we come on the Pesach and we say, we have emptied our home. We have emptied our jurisdictions of all this holy food. We have done everything we're supposed to do. It's called a vidui. We confess or acknowledge for God that we did this. So the language is, v'loy biyarti mimenu. I didn't use this, meaning the ma'aser sheni, b'tamei, when I was in a state of ritual impurity. Ah, said the Gemara. So it's this that can't be used when it's in a state of ritual impurity. Mimenu, this. However, other things you would be able to. And the Gemara came back with the refrain. That what does that mean? Mimenu iatamavir, mimenu from it, min the ma'aser sheni. You cannot use in a state of ritual impurity. Avalata mavir shemen shel truma. But if it's shemen of truma, you can incinerate that. You can light your menorah. You can light your Shabbos candles. You can even kindle your ordinary everyday lamps and go about your business. That's all fine. So that was everything we learned up until now. And now the Gemara comes back and asks a question. Who says that argument is ironclad? Ve'ema mimenui atam havir. Maybe it means ma'aser sheni can't be used in a state of ritual impurity. Aval atam havir shemen shel kodesh shenitma. But what if it was oil from the Beit HaMikdash, which is called Kodesh? It's designated for a holy purpose, a sacred purpose. What's the sacred and holy purpose? To be used in the Beit HaMikdash for the purpose of offerings only. Ah, so maybe the Ma'aser Sheni can't be used in a mundane way, but, or for your own benefit, but you could use the Shemen Shel Kodesh Shenitma. In other words, we came to the conclusion, Ma'aser Sheni can't be used in a state of ritual impurity. Can't be benefited from. But Truma, it could be benefited from. To which the Gemara responds, 1 second. Who says that's the teaching? Mimenu is a teaching. Mimenu is specific. Mimenu is exclusionary. This cannot be benefited from when it's in a state of ritual impurity. Other things can be benefited from when they are in a state of ritual impurity. What must it be? Oh, it has to be Truma. What else would it be? Says the Gemara, I can think of something else. Maybe it's excluding something from the Beis HaMikdash. Maybe something from the Beis HaMikdash that became ritually impure can no longer be used in its typical fashion, but it still can be benefited from. Who says not? So the Gemara comes back with a refrain and says, how could you say that? How could you say that? Lav kal v'chomer hu. Is it not heavy and light? Everybody knows what a kal v'chomer is, right? Kal v'chomer is a method of argument. It's a method of when you want to demonstrate something or prove something through analysis. So kal v'chomer means heavy and light. In Latin, we call this methodology a fortiori. Simply stated, how many pounds can you lift over your head? How many pounds can you lift? 500 pounds? 200 pounds? 50 pounds? Can you lift a bag of flour 50 pounds over your head? Okay, I buy that. You look like a guy who can lift 50 pounds over his head. So now that I discovered you can lift 50 pounds, can you lift 80 pounds? No. I don't know. The fact that I know, somebody said I saw Jake lift 50 pounds over his head. So I know for sure that Jake can lift 50 pounds. How do I know for sure? Because I saw him do it. Now, can he lift 80 pounds? I don't know. The only way I could know if you can lift 80 pounds is if I'd see you lift 80 pounds. 1 second. How about 25 pounds? Do I need to see you lift 25 pounds? Why not? If you can lift 50, lift 25. That's the light and heavy argument. Very simple. If something intense, heavy can be done, for sure something light can be done. So in our example, we say it's a kal vachomer. What's a kal vachomer? The kal vachomer would be uma meiser hakal. Meiser is light. But of course, this is not about mass, density, or weight. This talks about severity, how carefully it has to be treated. So meiser hakal, omra teira, I cannot use when it's in a state of ritual impurity. If Maiser HaKal, which belongs to me personally, it's not the Beis HaMikdash property, it's Maiser HaKal. If that can't be used in a state of ritual impurity, Kodesh, that which is not my property, but rather the jurisdiction of the Beis HaMikdash, Leikoshke, would it not be obvious? Or, as Sherlock Holmes would have said, elementary, my Watson? Self-understood, self-evident.
But you have linen and wool together. We're not allowed, but in the Beis HaMikdash they were allowed.
Okay. You're actually raising a good point. So for the benefit of everybody out there, you're asking about linen and wool, the forbidden mixture of linen and wool, which is permitted in the Beis HaMikdash, it's not permitted outside the Beis HaMikdash. Okay, so that's a good question, but it doesn't really enter the conversation here, and I'll tell you why not. Because it is possible that in a rarefied environment, unusual things can be done. That which couldn't be done on a regular day could be done, or in a regular place could be done in a rarefied place. Why would that be permitted is a good question. Why would it even be a mitzvah? Because it is a mitzvah. Some of the clothing of the Kohanim has to be mixture. That's an excellent question. Rabbeinu Bechaya talks about that. It's a question for another day. But here we're talking about the same thing, a common thing. It's not something else. Here we're talking about something which is very stringent and something which is somewhat stringent. The somewhat stringent, you cannot benefit from the state of ritual impurity. Is it not self-understood that the thing which is much more severe in its restrictions could not be benefited from when it's in a state of ritual impurity?
Unless the Torah said it
could be. But we would reason, if we would have to reason, we'd say for sure, it's self-understood. So the Gemara says, well, if that's the case, if you're telling me that it's a kal vachomer, and that if meiser, which is not so stringent and not so severe, can't or could be used, I can derive instantaneously, self-evidently, that something which is more severe wouldn't be able to be used. Well, the Gemara says, in that case, imkein ihachi, if so, truma nami lema kal vachomer. Let's say the same thing about truma. Truma is the holy food which belongs to the Kohen. Truma is much holier and therefore much more restricted than Maaser Sheni is. Maaser Sheni is for everybody. Every Jew can eat Maaser Sheni. What's the precondition? You find yourself in the city of Yerushalayim and you're in a state of ritual purity. Truma, it's not good enough to be in Yerushalayim. It's not good enough to be in a state of ritual impurity. You have to be a Kohen. So the Gemara comes back. Haksiv mimenu. It says mimenu. Mimenu means it, meaning the Maaser Sheni can't be used in the state of ritual impurity. So the Gemara says, so we know it excludes something. So therefore, what must it exclude? It excludes Truma, that Truma should be able to be used. So the Gemara says, Umarais, who says, we have three different substances here. Maaser Sheni, we said, no, if it's ritual impurity, can't benefit from it. But we know this can't be benefited, something else could be. What might that other thing be? I have two choices. One is Truma, and one is Kodesh. Kodesh is much more severe than Truma. So the Gemara says, Kodesh loy mematinon. We would say that the Kodesh is not the thing that's being excluded, because if we're being ma'atena Kodesh, Kodesh is unique, or separate, or better, or more severe, or restricted in no less than six ways. Shekain Simon Panak Akam. I vowelize it that way. We don't know how to vowelize this. It doesn't have a particular pronunciation, which means Pei Nun Kuf Ayin Chof Mem. Okay, you look inside. And the Gemara now is going to translate and tell us, what does this stand for? What exactly is the acronym of Peinun Kuf and Ayin Chaf Mem? The Gemara now begins to unfold the accordion. Okay, Pei. Pei stands for Pigel. You know what Pigel is? Pigel means, if when you were serving in the Beit HaMikdash, the Kohen had the wrong thoughts, what happens to the offering? It's disqualified. For example, the Kohen thought, this Korban will be eaten next week, but the Korban has to be eaten that night. It becomes disqualified. Why? Because it has to be treated in accordance with the rules that the Torah imposes, and if the Kohen so much as thinks inappropriately, it's no good. You know what this is like? If a person is writing a Sefer Torah, but he's not thinking about the holiness of a Sefer Torah, he's thinking about the beauty of calligraphy. What happens to that Sefer Torah? It's not kosher. Especially the Shem Hashem. It's a problem. It's written intentfully. I'll tell you another little secret. You want to really fulfill the mitzvah of matzah on the night of Pesach? You have to eat the matzah that was baked intentfully by a Jew who knew that he or she was rolling the matzah and baking it so that another Jew would be able to eat this matzah on the night of Pesach, which is why we really disdain the consumption of machine matzah on Pesach. Now, we're not saying the machine matzah isn't kosher. We're not saying that the machine matzah isn't more precise, perhaps even. And, you know, human beings make mistakes, machines don't, except when they do. But that's the difference in a machine and a person. A person's got a neshama. And you harness the neshama, you harness the soul by the powers of your mind. And when a Jew does something intentfully, because he was gifted a neshama, he marshals his spiritual powers and he or she invests the physical materiality that you are working with a sense of holiness. Machines don't have neshamas. And robots don't have souls. And robots have no fuzzy logic. They can only think the way they were programmed to think. Robots get to make no freedom of choice. The robot can't be good or bad. It can just be a robot. You understand? Machine's like a robot. So machine matzah, it's lacking holiness. Because really holy matzah has to be made by a really holy Jew. You know which Jew is really holy? Any Jew. You devoted yourself to baking matzah? That's a holy act. The matzah is holy. So you go to a matzah bakery, and the mashgiach says to all the ladies who are rolling over there, for some reason it's usually ladies rolling, although men can roll the same way. Maybe women are more gifted at rolling. And then the men are usually at the oven, getting roasted over there. And he says, everybody together! And everybody cries out, L'shei matzahs mitzvah.
There has to be intent.
Has to be intent, yeah. We verbalize that. Huh?
The guy's thinking he's rolling the matzah to make money.
Well, you know, rolling matzah to make a living is nice too, but you have to be thinking about the mitzvah also. It is for the purpose of a mitzvah. So if the Kohen does his work in the Beit HaMikdash and he executes his work like a ballerina, exactly what he's supposed to do. But the problem is he was thinking about the wrong thing. What happens to the Kohen to the food? It's disqualified. It's pigel. That's pay. Then there's notar. Notar means if the food was left overnight. For example, a Korban Pesach has to be eaten on the night of Pesach. What happens if day breaks and the food, the Korban, the meat from the Korban was not eaten? What happens to it? It goes bad. It expires. What do you have to do with it now? You have to burn it. Very good. And then there's Korban. What does this mean? Korban, Chassidus tells us, is a permutation of the Hebrew word which means kiruv, or closeness. Korban is a mechanism for closeness with God. We nurture relationship through the Korban. The Korban is sacred. It's very close. It draws you close. The Truma is lifted, but doesn't draw you close in the same fashion. And so, it's not the same as Truma. Truma does not have any of these rules. So we have three things that the Korban, or the things which come from the Beis HaMikdash, are more severe. There's another three things. Now we have the idea of the Ayin Chaf Mem. What's the Ayin Chaf Mem? So a person who loses a loved one prior to the funeral is considered to be what we call in Hebrew onen. Onan means in a state of meltdown. And in this state of meltdown, you cannot consume a korban. The Kohen can eat his truma food, but he cannot, he would not be allowed to eat the korban. Sorry, I skipped a little bit. The ayin stands for me'ila. Me'ila means if you use the korban for personal purposes, you violate its holiness. An act of sacrilege. And if you do so accidentally, you have to pay a special fine to the Beis HaMikdash, as well as bring a korban to atone for yourself. And then there's kares. Kares means a person dies prematurely, usually before the age of 60, and a person will die childless, lose his children also. Very severe. And then there's the onan. So we have all these different things which basically add up to be more stringent about the korban. So if I know that this is one thing is being ruled out, one and not the other, which am I going to say? Which is it ruling out? If one is more stringent than one is not, which would you assume is the more stringent one?
The holier
one's the more stringent. So what must we be saying when we say mimenu? It can't be used. What can be used then? The truma can be used. That's how the Gemara reasons. Maisa Sheni is less holy.
But
granted.
Can't be used.
Right. But Maisa Sheni, the Torah specifically says can't be used. And it's so specific, it says mimenu. And from mimenu we derive it, not something else. So the Gemara comes back and says, Adraba. As they say in Spanish, el contraire, the opposite should be true. Truma loimimatina, the truma should not be separated, should not be excluded. Shekain machpaz. And here we're going to now go through four things that the truma is special. Number one, by truma, if you violate it, you have something called misa b'deh shemayim. Misa b'deh shemayim could mean that you die prematurely and doesn't necessarily have to have a date attached to it. And there's something called a choymish. A choymish means if you violate the Kohen special food, you cannot pay back the same amount of what you violated. You have to add an additional fifth. So, if you violated $100 worth of food, how much you have to pay back to the Kohen? 120. Very good. And what happens? So we have this idea of Misa B'deh Shemayim. We have the Chaymish. And then, if something is supposed to be used for Beis HaMikdash purposes, but in the end, for whatever reason, it couldn't be used, what do? You redeem it. That's called Pidyon. When it comes to Truma, you cannot be Poide. And some Korbanot can be eaten by non-Kohanim, who are called Zarim, strangers for holiness. However, Truma is Asura Lazarim. The Truma is prohibited. We're now on page 25, side B. So in that case, the Gemara says, it's true, you have isolated unique properties about the truma. We have isolated previously unique properties about that which is used for holy purpose. Hanoch nefishim, we have more holy things, more restrictions for the truma. And since we have more restrictions for the truma, logic would tell us that if you have to exclude one thing, what would it be? The truma. Not the Kodesh. And that's how the Gemara finishes off the logic. The Gemara now says, Iboyesema, and if you want, you can answer. Kodesh Chamur. The Kodesh is more severe. And how do we know that? Shekain Oynish Kores. Because Kores is a worse punishment. Kores means you die prematurely. Misa B'deh Shemayim means you die prematurely. But Kores, it seems, you die without children. Your children predecease you. Whereas Misa B'deh Shemayim, the children can live on, and that way we see it's more severe. And so, whether these punishments actually happen in real time or not is a subject for another day. And that's not the point now. The point, however, we're saying is that the fact that the Torah attaches this kind of stringency to it means that Beit HaMikdash material would be more stringent than Kohanic material. So if there was one thing which could be permitted, it would have to be the Kohanic material. And that is actually the halach. The truma, which is tomei, has to be burnt, but you can benefit from the incineration. So practically speaking, a Kohen can use Shemen Truma, Shemen Tummy, pardon me, for his menorah. Can't eat it. Can't rub it into his skin. But he can use it to light the Hanukkah candles, or the Hanukkah lamps, or for that matter, the Shabbat lamps. The Gemara now finishes off and says, let me give you one more source for the idea that Truma, which is Tameh, cannot be eaten, but can be benefited from. Says the Gemara, Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak, Omar Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak said, Omar Kra, the Torah says about the Truma, Titein Lo, give it to him. Give it to him. What does it mean, give it to him? Give it to him means Lo. Lo means to him, meaning for his benefit. Velola Oro. Don't say, oh, Rabbi Cohen, I have a gift for you. What would you like to give me? I want to give you Shemen Zayas. Oh, that's great. My wife is going to be making dinner tonight. Oh, no, sorry. This Shemen Zayas is tummy. But you can use it to light your menorah. What kind of gift is that? You give a gift that can't be used? Or a gift that has a very slender use? It should be able to be used in any way. So it's Titein Lo, give it to him. And therefore we learn, if something is in a state of ritual impurity, you cannot separate Truma from it. You'd have to separate Truma from something else. Truma must be separated in a state of purity. So, Rav Nachman bar Yitzchak finishes off. Since the Torah has to come and tell you, Titein Lo, make sure you give it to him with all of its uses available, Miklal, from this I could understand, the Bat Orohu, that it is, so to speak, a daughter of its light. It's a euphemism, meaning the light could be used, but that's not the right way to give the Truma. But from this you can understand, the light could be used. And so, my dear friends, in conclusion, we now have a clarity about this sacred food called Truma. When it's in a state of ritual impurity, it cannot be eaten and used as an edible. However, it can be used to benefit. In what way? The light that's generated through its incineration could be useful for us. And that's the story of the Truma. The Gemara now has finished its discussion, its analysis of the beginning of the Mishnah. The Gemara will return to analyzing the different kinds of fuel which can or cannot be used to kindle the Shabbat lamps.